You seek the key, but first you must learn the ways of precision, craft, and performance with Acura's all-electric ZDX. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system, up to a 313-mile range, and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is their most powerful SUV yet. Unlock the energy when you visit Acura.com to order yours today.
Hear that? It's the call of the Crave. And when the Crave calls, you know what to do. Try the $5 bacon bundle, because the only thing better than a White Castle slider is a White Castle slider topped with crispy hickory smoked bacon. So pick any two of either the bacon cheese slider, 1921 bacon cheese slider, or chicken bacon ranch slider. And also get a small fry for just $5 with the $5 bacon bundle. White Castle. Follow your Crave.
I am obsessed with not losing any of my brain ability as I get older. And I'm also really nervous about dementia and Alzheimer's. My grandmother had Alzheimer's. In fact, I would like my brain to be smarter as I get older, if such a thing's possible. So I had on neuroscientist Dr. Mark Milstein, who just wrote a book, The Age-Proof Brain, New Strategies to Improve Memory, Protect Immunity, and Fight Off Dementia. It's a great book, great conversation. Here we go.
This isn't your average business podcast, and he's not your average host. This is the James Altucher Show.
In the book, The Age-Proof Brain, you offer solutions to maybe avoid dementia. I didn't know you could avoid things or postpone things like Alzheimer's or dementia.
Yeah, so that's what we're seeing, is that it's not destiny in a vast majority of cases, and that we have things that we can do. I like to say in the book, little things, because nobody wants to make major changes. So how do we do little things that can protect our brain and really also get the best out of it each day? And so we do see that we can lower risk of dementia anywhere from 30 to 60%. I know that's a big range, but that's where the studies are showing us. And it's about some lifestyle factors.
And I didn't know this either, that dementia is what Alzheimer's causes, and other things cause dementia too. But that's like sort of the end goal of Alzheimer's is dementia. I thought maybe it was like, oh, everybody gets a little bit of dementia, but some people get it really serious with Alzheimer's. So I really didn't know too well all the lingo there.
Yeah, it's a common misconception. And part of it is because for years, the terms were used interchangeably. So it was just used in the same manner, but now we really separate them and say that dementia is symptoms, the symptoms of memory loss, which, as you said, can be caused by many, many different things. It could be, you know, injuries, it could be other conditions. Alzheimer's is one specific condition that causes the symptoms of memory loss. So it's a very specific pathology or things that are happening in the brain that cause that memory loss. It's the most common cause of dementia, so it's, you know, critically important we talk about it.
Yeah, and so far it seems they don't really know for sure what causes Alzheimer's. Like you mentioned in the book, for instance, the plaque that builds up in the neurons, but you also mentioned tangles that build up inside the brain cells. And, you know, I didn't know that there were, I always thought it was the plaque stuff, but recent studies have shown that drugs that cure the plaque stuff don't really work on Alzheimer's as well as people thought they would.
Yeah, so it's what we're seeing is happening is it's multiple factors. I like to say it's like the straw that breaks the camel's back. It's a mix of this waste, plaques, tangles. It's also metabolism, so the brain's not using sugar like it used to. It's inflammation, so that the immune system is attacking the brain. And we believe it's just this basically compounding effects, and they build up over time. And so just dealing with the plaques or the tangles is probably not enough. It might show some benefits. There's some trials going on right now where we're seeing some help, but where we saw a lot of benefit in cancer treatments is when it was a cocktail of medications that went after multiple underlying issues. And the evidence is suggesting it's going to be the same thing with Alzheimer's.
You also mentioned like there are people who have a ton of plaque, a ton of tangles. They're over the age of 100 and they're doing crossword puzzles every day and skiing or whatever. And so they have all this evidence that they should have Alzheimer's or dementia, but they don't. So that also indicates there's things we don't understand or know about ultimately what's causing dementia.
Yeah. So Alzheimer's induced a dementia. Specifically, it's not just the plaques. And that is why we believe those medications alone are not as successful as we thought they would have been. And that it's inflammation, the immune system attacking the brain. It's the loss of the ability to use sugar, and also some other factors that we just don't know. So it's not just one thing. And although that seems more complex, it actually gives us hope because it means that there are multiple avenues that we can pursue to lessen the risk and develop better therapeutics and treatments.
So I guess, I want to hear about what some of those lifestyle changes are. And you know, one thing I was thinking is you have this one story of a nun who's 102 years old, who's solving crossword puzzles every day. She's smart, she's quick-witted. And then when she dies, she's the example you use to show she had a lot of plaque and a lot of tangles, all the things that would indicate in the brain she should have dementia, but she didn't. I'm wondering if she had such a simple lifestyle, like basically her whole lifestyle was regimented for her being a nun. And it's a very, and I'm sure in her older ages, she didn't have as many responsibilities. I bet when you have like a zero stress life, that probably helps.
Well, it's interesting you mention that because what we see is that it's actually some amount of stress is actually quite good for the brain. If we look at we kind of think of the brain like a car. Like if you don't drive it and you leave it in the garage, it falls apart. And if you overdrive it, it falls apart. So we actually see that some amount of stress actually helps memory, helps let the brain know that the brain needs to keep functioning and needs to keep working. It's that cortisol, that stress hormone in a burst. It's like primes the brain cells, helps them, keeps them healthy, keeps them youthful. But if it's too much too often, if it's never ending or we can't take a break from it or it's overwhelming, that's when we see damage to brain cells and damage to memory. So we're actually thinking about stress in a bit of a different way, which is we want engagement. We want things we want to get done. We just don't want it to be overwhelming or too much too often.
So I'm curious about all these things, like what one can do and you mentioned a lot of lifestyle habit changes that are fairly easy to do that could reduce or eliminate or at least help with dementia, Alzheimer's stuff. But I'm also curious about age-related decline, as I mentioned before, as related to someone like me, someone, you know, over the age of 50, who in a very visceral way, it's not like I have dementia or senility or anything like that. I'm not, you know, I don't have that, but I could see the difference between myself in my 20s. And I'm sure a lot of people experience that when they're in their 50s.
Yeah. So starting at the age of 40, actually, the brain starts to shrink about 5% about every 10 years. And so that shrinking can have an impact on memory, focus, productivity, day-to-day ability to just sort of get things done at the same rate or productivity level as previously. But as you mentioned, we see that there are things that we can do not only to slow that down, but also be aware that we want to say that there's certain things that are going to decline, you know, maybe the speed of calculations, for example, but we can increase our ability to have wisdom or perspective. So there is a balance there, but in overall, what we see is that we can take care of the brain. There are going to be some skills that, you know, might get not as robust, not as strong, but we can do things to keep our brain working better, longer. And also on the other hand, there's evidence that when people do the things where I think we're going to talk about that, you know, even people in their 60s, 70s, 80s, when they optimize their sleep, manage their stress, think about the things they're eating, that their ability of their processing speed of their brain does go up. Their ability to run their day goes up. Their ability to score on tests goes up. So we do have evidence that these interventions can be powerful. At the same time, you know, as we get older, we do have to be aware that things can slow down. And if it's happening here or there, that can be normal, but if it's happening at an increased rate or increased frequency, or we're seeing major changes, we actually want to get the message out that we don't want to say that that's just a normal part of aging, because we see that there are things we can do to slow it down. So we want to be on top of it and not just say, oh, that's, you know, just part of the aging process. Because as we get into our 60s, what we're seeing is something that's much more common than we thought, called mild cognitive impairment, which is people starting to not have dementia, where it's the inability to, you know, get through the day based upon memory issues, but there's some significant memory issues. And in the past, people said, oh, that's just the aging process. Well, now we know that that shouldn't be happening. So we want to make some distinctions about if things are getting significantly worse, we're noting any changes, we want to get on top of it because we see that we can make improvements.
But it sounds like it is in part the aging process. Like you said, the brain gets smaller, which I want to ask you about. So you have to do these lifestyle changes. Like in your 20s, you don't have to do the lifestyle changes. Maybe you're not living optimally for your brain, but you could kind of have a laissez-faire attitude towards your brain health because you're still going to, your brain's still large. And then when you're older, you kind of have to do these things. Like one of the first things I did after reading your book was go immediately to the dentist and, you know, check on gingivitis and things like that. Because that's like this chronic inflammation. And you mentioned how inflammation affects the brain. And I had some, so I had to do like a cleaning and antibiotics and hopefully that will help. But what you're saying is basically that even if one is experiencing some decline, we don't really know what their potential is until they start, you know, adjusting to these lifestyle changes.
Yeah, absolutely. And so that, you know, I'm glad that you made that step, taking the information and making the action step. That's great. Because yeah, exactly what you're saying is that inflammation that seems so minor or so insignificant can spread to the brain and cause an inflammation or the immune system attacking the brain. And also what you're saying is true. You know, when we're in our, you know, teens or 20s, getting a good night's sleep is good. It's beneficial. And we see people perform better, you know, in athletics if they get a good night's sleep, but there's more of a leeway. There's more of a buffer. And then as we get older, there's less of a buffer. And I think that's not, we don't need scientific studies to show us that. We just feel that as we get older, that, you know, what used to be something you could get away with is harder to get away with as you get older.
Yeah. So, you know, so a lot of people listening to this, they might not be in their 70s or 80s, but they might be caring for someone who is, or they also might be younger and they like to keep optimal brain health, or they might be like me, like somewhere in the middle. And you know, why does the brain shrink, first of all? Like what is shrinking? Is it one part of the brain or is it the entire brain?
Essentially overall, part of it is that as we get older, this waste that builds up in the brain becomes harder to get rid of. And there's several reasons for that. The older that we get, we're not sleeping as well as we used to. And so when we sleep at night, we're actually squeezing trash and waste out of the brain and essentially washing it away through something we call basically the brainwash process. So when that trash builds up, it can damage brain cells and cause them to shrink. That's one thing that can be happening. Also, as we get older, part of our aging process is that our immune system doesn't work as well. And so we're not as good often as fighting off viruses or having our immune system understand when it's time to take a break, that, you know, don't attack the joints, don't attack the heart, don't attack the gut, don't attack the brain. And so by the immune system, essentially thinking of it like an army attacking the brain, that can shrink the brain as well. So the hopeful side of all this is that we see that the lifestyle factors that we're talking about here, optimizing your sleep, thinking about inflammation, thinking about your dental health, these things can keep basically aspects of your brain healthier by alleviating or minimizing those factors that can do the damage.
And you know, I wonder, like, let's say sleep, that's something that you could, you know, treat medically. Like I could take a sleeping pill, for instance, or melatonin. And is it cheating? Does it not work if I use artificial means to sleep?
Well, we see that natural sleep is best. So things to think about are that the over-the-counter sleep aids, for example, you know, or the people say they'll take an allergy pill, for example, that has the side effect that can make you feel drowsy. That's an area where, you know, you can feel like, oh, I'm doing something helpful for my brain because I'm going to be getting more sleep. But we realize that it's not just the number of hours of sleep that you're getting. It's how effective and the quality of that sleep. And so if we go back to that idea of that washing process, for example, with the over-the-counter sleep aids, we see that people who use those long-term, on average, develop memory issues earlier. And we believe part of what's happening, there's two main things that are happening there. One is that we believe that these over-the-counter sleep aids or these drowsy-inducing medications like allergy pills that people often use to fall asleep, they don't allow the brain to go through that washing process. So there's too much of this waste left over. And if you just think of your brain like a house or an apartment, there's too much trash or, you know, garbage around, it's hard to find things, hard to focus, hard to be productive. So we want to make sure that each night we're getting that brain washing, brain cleansing sleep. And the other thing is that we realize that If we're turning to these things, these solutions, for example, the over-the-counter sleep aids, they have something in them called anticholinergic. They're they minimize a compound in the brain that's just critical for memory. So the science is very sound that we see that these solutions are not things we want to turn to. And instead, we've learned so much about how the brain works that we want to turn to those things in terms of, you know, optimizing our sleep. And we can talk about some of those things if you'd like how do you get the good night's sleep without turning to the sleeping aid?
Yeah, no, that is interesting. So Arianna Huffington a long time ago wrote a book about sleep and how she suffered from lack of sleep and then really did some research on this and wrote a book about it. And I had her on the podcast to talk about it, but that was a long time ago. Like, what are one or two suggestions? And I admit that sometimes using aids to sleep.
Yeah. I mean, it's when we hear about how important sleep is, it's so easy to turn to things that we think are helping, but they're not helpful. So instead, one of the most powerful tips is not anything you're doing while you're sleeping or before bed, but it's in the morning. And there's this discovery that won the Nobel Prize, essentially, that there's a brain clock in your head. There's like a little tiny clump of brain cells that's kind of like a countdown timer that helps you fall asleep at night and helps you essentially get a better night's sleep. And you start the countdown in the morning by getting outside in the presence of natural light. The study suggests about 10 minutes within about a half hour of getting up. And this brain clock essentially starts the countdown in the morning that's going to help you fall asleep at night. So it sounds really simple, but a lot of us either work from home or we jump in a car or a public transportation, we go to work, go to an office. We're just missing out on morning light and something so small, so something that seems like so silly, but it's in our modern world, we can overlook it. And so just, you know, when you wake up in the morning, take a walk, walk the dog, check the mail, go to the front yard, the backyard, a balcony, let your brain get that morning light. That's really powerful. It's become a new field called chronobiology. We realize this brain clock regulates sleep, mood, metabolism. You know, our brain is tuned to the light and dark cycles, and sometimes we can easily overlook that. So I would say that something very powerful is try a little bit more morning light as something that can help you sleep that night.
And is it true that you have to sleep 8 straight hours? Like, can I sleep 4 hours, get up for a while, and then sleep 4 hours? Or does it have to be like, does the washing occur if the sleep's continuous?
Yeah, so the washing, and that's another thing, is I hope that nobody hears this podcast and says they're going to wake up at 2 in the morning and say, "No, I'm not getting my brain washed. I'm more stressed than ever. I wish I didn't hear about this." So just to reiterate or to highlight some key points is that you sleep in about a 90-minute cycle, and within that 90 minutes, you have a brain wash. And then at the end of the 90-minute cycle, you're dreaming, and you're basically paralyzed from the neck down so you don't act out your dreams. And at the end of the 90 minutes, you actually wake up. And you actually move a little. It's actually normal. So really an important message for people is it's okay to wake up throughout the night. You actually wake up every 90 minutes, about every 90 minutes. You're not conscious of all those awakenings, but it's okay to wake up. It's normal. It's part of the process. We're really not meant to just get in bed and stay asleep. Some people are not aware of the wake up, so they feel like they're sleeping, you know, a certain number of hours straight, but you actually do wake up. It's okay to wake up. If you wake up tonight, remind yourself you just had a brainwash in that cycle. We just want to have several of these washes throughout the night to optimize that cleaning process. But by no means do you have to have this feeling like I'm laying in bed, I go to sleep, and I just wake up a certain number of hours later, and there was no disruption throughout the night.
And you also mentioned the role of like anxiety and depression on future dementia. Like why? Like anxiety is kind of and I think related to this is you mentioned how this generation we're seeing more instances of dementia than ever. And my initial instinct was, is that because people are living longer in general? But, you know, I don't think that's it. I think maybe we're more stressed in our daily lives.
Yeah. So part of it is that we're living longer. That's a piece of the puzzle. But it's also the factors of all these underlying conditions. There's some environmental factors that we believe are happening, toxins in our environment, and also things that, you know, we're still learning about. But when we talk about anxiety and depression, what we do see, and this actually just came out this year, this study, that found that if anxiety and depression are not treated, if they're not managed, if they're not treated effectively, they increase the risk of dementia years down the road. So individuals who have unmanaged anxiety or depression, if you follow them, what you see happens is that on average, they lose their memory about 5 years earlier than individuals that don't have those conditions. And so what we believe is happening is those conditions, anxiety, depression, they can have an inflammatory component too. In some cases, those individuals are not sleeping as well. And they're impacting some of the lifestyle factors that we're talking about as well. So really the message is that our mental health today is impacting our long-term brain health down the road. But, you know, the hopeful side of this is that the things that we're talking about, optimizing sleep, thinking about things that we're eating, all these intervention, little lifestyle things, they're important for mental health today and they're important for brain health down the road. So it's not like we have to do a whole new set of things. They can be beneficial for both.
Yeah, and you have a list of foods in one chapter towards the end that are good for the brain. So I'll let people just, you know, find that in the book. One question I have about like certain vitamins, you mentioned vitamin D, is, you know, yeah. I've talked to different scientists about vitamin D and vitamin C, and some people just don't believe that they work at all. Some people think that it doesn't get absorbed into the body correctly. Like, is there, you know, and then there's companies that, you know, will come over your house and intravenously with an IV give you all the vitamins you need. And so what's the best way to take like vitamin D, for instance, other than I get it sunlight, but in terms of supplements and food?
Yeah, really we can take supplements and put them all in the same category, which is lots of conflicting data. And so really when we see things that are this conflicting, we basically break it down this way, that people once or twice a year, just like you went out and went to the dentist, that was a really great step, is once or twice a year, go to the doctor and just get a blood test and test for these things, the things that supplements would be dealing with. And if anything is deficient, first try to deal with it with food, because we see that, as you said, the food absorbs better than these supplements. We see that clearly. If food is not alleviating the issue, then supplements can be used, but we want to use them in a way that somebody's coming back, you know, a year, 6 months or a year later, because vitamin D is the perfect example of something where it's in the news and the message seems to be that everybody needs more vitamin D. Well, if you need it, if you're not getting enough, that's true. But if you're taking too much of it, that can also cause issues with memory and cause issues
really?
With cognition. So what we realize is that overdosing on these things is a problem too. So really we want people to just take that extra step and make sure that they need it. And if they need it, take it, but not be overdosing on it.
Wow. So I think I've been, you know, when COVID started, I started taking a lot of all these things like vitamin D, zinc, magnesium, vitamin C. I wonder if I've been like doing too much. Like I'll take 10,000 IUs, for instance, of vitamin D. Do you think that's too much?
It depends upon somebody's absorption, but I would say that get that blood test, see where you are. And if you're at the levels too high in the range, then, you know, too much of any of these things that we know these mega doses that, you know, were popular quite a few years ago can be in the category of where it can be doing more harm than good. So we want to be in the normal ranges. So, you know, I keep coming back to it, but I'm just so impressed you went to the dentist. You actually, you know, you made that step.
I'll get my blood done.
Yeah, just get that once or twice a year physical blood work. And if anything is too low, address it with food. If not, if that's not working, supplements. If something's too high, then think about cutting some things back for sure.
Yes, it's totally true. Airbnb has changed my life. If anything, they have made my life so much better. Like I used to live in Airbnbs. I lived in over 100 or 200 different Airbnbs over a 3-year period. And I loved it. I became a really good guest of Airbnbs and I got to know lots of hosts. So when I initially owned a house, the first thing I thought was, I'm going to turn my house into an Airbnb because I travel a lot. So why leave my house unused when I can make a side income by letting others Airbnb my house or come to stay in my house as guests? And having my own Airbnb or being a host for Airbnb has allowed me to do just that. And I've met other hosts. I've actually spoken at Airbnb's host conference. I think it was in 2017. I met so many just nice hosts. It's a great community. And I love, you know, turning my own home into an Airbnb. Like I'm traveling to Austin next month. My home's going to be an Airbnb while I'm away. And I'll stay in an Airbnb. I'd rather stay in like a 3-story house Airbnb than in one tiny hotel room in the middle of Austin during South by Southwest. So listen, while you're away, your home could be an Airbnb. Many people host on Airbnb, but there are people who are just letting their house sit empty, who've never thought about it or didn't realize their space could be an Airbnb. Hosting can easily fit into your lifestyle and is a great way to earn some extra money. So if you have a home, but you're not always at home, then you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. I remember last year I was asked to go speak at the Norway Business Summit, and I was so excited because side by side with the Business Summit was the Norway Chess Summit, where I would get to see in person Magnus Carlsen, the best chess player ever, playing chess. But it was 4 plane rides, like, to get to the city that ultimately I would go to. So I really did not want to fly for 14 hours, and they were willing to pay for everything for me. So I at first class. So I didn't want to fly for 14 hours and not be first class. So I had to hurry up and get on the phone immediately to get those first class tickets to a chess tournament in Norway. And listen, this is just like when, you know, you have to know when you want the best of anything, you have to act quickly or someone else will get it instead. And I did not want those seats to fill up. So it's like if you're hiring for your business, you want to find the most talented people for your open roles before the competition scoops them up. I just was talking to a friend this morning where he was trying to decide between some programmers and he waited a little too long and both the programmers he was interviewing took other jobs, like great jobs. So, you know, what's the best way then to hire the best as quickly as possible? ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter finds qualified candidates fast. And right now, you could try it for free at ZipRecruiter.com/James. Just try it and see. You'll find out. So ZipRecruiter's powerful matching technology takes center stage to identify the top talent for your roles. Immediately after you post your job, ZipRecruiter's smart technology starts showing you qualified people for it. And I know this because one time I signed up as an employee, potential employee on ZipRecruiter, and I got nonstop, really, I was, even though obviously I wasn't looking for a job, I love what I do, but I just wanted to see what would happen because they were a sponsor of my podcast. And the most interesting jobs would pop up in my emails like, hey, you're qualified for this or that. And so it's interesting to see. So just go there and try it. Try ZipRecruiter.com/James. Amp up your hiring performance. Now, this is more for if you're hiring, but amp up your hiring performance with ZipRecruiter and find the best fast. See why 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. Just go to this exclusive web address right now to try ZipRecruiter for free. ZipRecruiter.com/James. Again, that's ZipRecruiter.com/James. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Now, is it a myth that solving puzzles or math problems or doing memory quizzes or Sudoku, is it a myth, or chess even, is it a myth that this helps the brain at all or even as maintenance?
So learning new things is one of the best things you can do for your brain. We see this consistently in many, many studies. So the message is that we don't want people to think that as long as I do a crossword puzzle, I'm good, and I ignore everything else. In most cases, what we see, it's multiple factors. So it's a piece of the puzzle. It's one thing that's important to do. And so crossword puzzles, Sudoku, chess, anything that's mentally stimulating is really, really good for the brain and should be prioritized. It's just not the only thing that we should be doing. And the way I like to think about it is cross-training your brain. So if you go to the gym, you're not going to just, you know, do bicep curls all day. Just like you shouldn't just do one a mentally stimulating activity. Think about 3 areas that you want to work out your brain. One is the mentally stimulating, you know, learning new things, playing chess, doing a crossword puzzle, taking a course in person or online. That's all excellent and should be prioritized, really important. New language, all that's great. But also think about doing something physical, like learning a new sport, yoga, dance. Balance is so important for our brain health. And as we get older, we can deprioritize like training our brain for balance, challenging it. And that's really important. It's a part of learning, but it's a physical learning. And the third thing is take some time during the week to be social. Like, go out with a friend, get coffee, talk to people, because that's a part of learning that's a little bit different than the crossword puzzle and the physical. So just thinking about your week and being like, I just want to make sure I'm doing some things during the week that where I'm doing something mentally stimulating that's new and different, something I don't do all the time. I also want to do something that's physical, that's new and different, that I'm learning a new physical skill. And then I want to make sure I'm socializing, you know, once or twice during the week at least, because that's where we see it's that kind of cross training. And all these different aspects work out different parts of the brain. And that's what we want to be doing. We don't want to just be working out one part of the brain or two parts of the brain. We want to be working out, kind of getting a full body, full brain workout.
So all this is great. And I do want to, I think there's some areas where I need to improve my brain health. I feel like I've been kind of naturally going in that direction over the years, but I could probably do a lot more. One thing, I want to get into some specifics. You mentioned how myelin are these sheaths that form around connections between neurons as people learn things. It's sort of like insulates the learning. And I know this is definitely a huge way kids, you know, protect and learn things in a very deep way, and that as you get old, it used to be that they thought only kids could do this, but it turns out that later in life, you also could build this myelin and have this myelination around the connections between neurons. How old before that stops happening?
We see that people can, it can slow down, but we see that people can have this process throughout their lifespan. I mean, there's not an end point. There's not a point where we would say, you know, despite somebody having some significant underlying condition, that we can make the brain work better, essentially at any age, we can improve upon. It doesn't mean things aren't going to slow down in some areas, but by challenging our balance, by, you know, dancing, moving, playing sports, learning new things, we see myelination throughout the lifespan. So that's this idea that, you know, your brain stops changing after a certain age is a myth that we definitely want to dispel.
But will the myelination develop as quickly as it did back then when you were a kid? Or are there ways to boost that? Is there some injection of myelin you could have so you have more myelin to put in your brain?
So in the developing brain time, which is, you know, from the time you're born to about 25, might be a little bit later for some individuals. But the idea is that's a very, you know, lots going on there. A lot of robust changes. The brain is under like, it's almost like you're remodeling a home and it's just determining what your personality is going to be like, things that are just happening very quickly. It's not the same for the rest of our life, but there are things that we can do to keep the myelination process strong. When we sleep, that's important to preserve that process. A lot of that happens during sleep. So if we're not sleeping well, that process can be diminished. The other thing is things that we eat. So we see that the omega-3s are what the myelin is essentially made of. So as you said, we basically think of your brain cells like a wire, and you wrap the wire in a coating to keep the electrical signal propagating. Otherwise, it would just kind of fizzle and wouldn't get to the next brain cell. And so the omega-3s are like the salmon, avocados, the healthy fats. We actually can't make myelin on our own. We get it through the things that we eat. And that's why when people say salmon is brain food, that's really what they mean, is that the omega-3 that comes in the salmon, that is integral to the salmon, you digest it, send it up to your brain, wrap your brain cells with it. And if we're not taking it in, that can be cause deficiencies in that process.
So I eat a lot of salmon. Like, that's probably the food I eat the most. I mean, in a sushi form, but I order from Grubhub or Uber Eats a lot. And I try to sleep 8 hours a day. I usually succeed at it. I try to move around, get sunlight and so on, and I try to get out and, you know, stare into the horizon during the first 15 minutes after I wake up. So I try to do all these things, but I've definitely experienced some decline that I've noticed, you know, because I can measure it. I can measure what I was like when I was in my 20s, and I can measure what I'm like now, particularly on the chessboards. I could see the difference. So I definitely don't calculate as fast, for instance. And my memory is definitely not as good. So I'm wondering, A, what's going on, and B, you know, is there more I can do to improve it?
So the things that you're doing are great. Think about, you know, the under any being aware of the underlying issues that are talked about in the book, heart health, gut health, you know, metabolism, any of those issues can have us diabetes, insulin resistance. These things are often overlooked, but they have a really powerful impact on the functioning of our brain. So in the book, I give that one piece of paper of the test to have in normal ranges, because we see if people keep those numbers in ranges, they really can optimize their brain health. Part of this is also, I'm a big baseball fan. I don't know if you're a baseball fan, but you know, pitchers early in their career, they often rely on velocity, the speed at which they're throwing the ball. And as they get older, we see that they can be highly successful, you know, into their 40s now, but they're not throwing velocity. They're using wisdom. They're using the skill of pitching, the craft, spinning the ball, placement. And it's very similar that we have to be aware that as we get older, there are some skills like, you know, pure velocity, pure speed that might diminish. We'll do everything we can to preserve that. You know, just like a pitcher is going to try to stay in the best shape possible, stretch, do all those things that are that to leverage. But as you mentioned with chess, and I know you know a lot more about chess than I do, much more, but the idea is that, you know, we want to be thinking about, well, what are the things that I can leverage that I can grow in skills and that I can use to my advantage that I didn't have earlier, and try to balance that so I can be, you know, executing at the highest level possible for as long as possible. Being aware that there is a point, you know, where velocity drops, you know, calculation speed does drop. We do everything we can to keep it going, but try to leverage the things that we're learning in terms of experience, execution, and think about this in all facets of life. So we do see certain skills do increase as we get older. Our ability to make decisions, things like that can increase. So it might not be the speed of the decision, but the quality of the decision can be sometimes optimized.
I wonder how you can practice quality decision-making. Like others, you know, like other things you can practice. I could move around and play tennis or yoga or whatever. Or I could sleep 8 hours. I could eat these foods. How do you practice? And I could even practice calculating math problems or solving, you know, doing memory quizzes. But how do you practice decision-making?
Yeah, there's actually some really interesting research there. And some interesting take-home tips on that are, one is, when you're making the decision, our decision-making abilities are likely different at different times of the day. There's been all these really interesting studies with like judges, for example, that they make better decisions after they eat, if they're not hungry. We're quick to make a worse decision if they're not sleep deprived. So just if you have to make a good decision, or if you make a decision that you want to be good, taking an assessment and saying, am I tired? Am I hungry? Because if those things are on the table, you might want to rectify those things first. Another thing to be aware of is, and I think what chess really teaches this is looking at things from multiple angles and multiple decisions. Like I'm going to be making this decision, but how do I look at this from somebody else's perspective? Like, what is the other perspective on this? Another interesting insight that research has shown us about decision-making is sometimes the time that we spend taking to make a decision will not impact the quality of the decision. They did these interesting studies with like generals who make decisions, and they found that if they spent a longer time making the decision, it didn't necessarily make them make a better decision. But what was really helpful was how they reacted to the outcome of that decision that they had just made. And so they're realizing like you're not going to be perfect in all your decision making. There will be flaws. There's errors within, you know, our decision making process. We can't know all the variables, but do your best to make a good decision. Be well fed. Get good sleep. Try to look at it from multiple angles. Try to not just look at it from your perspective. Then make the decision and then say, okay, I've made the decision. How am I now going to make the next best decision based upon how that decision worked out? So, you know, there's a whole area of interesting research there, but some things to think about and talk about.
You know, it's interesting about the food thing. Like I always wondered if you just ate, wouldn't your blood be kind of working on your, and all your brain energy, but working on digesting your food instead of helping you make decisions?
So the quality of what you're eating actually makes a difference. So they did this really interesting study where they had people eat essentially the same meal and they had them take a test. It was about an hour later. So it is possible like right after eating, you know, you might want to be careful, but you know, thinking about timing about an hour later, they essentially ate the same meal, but one was prepared with like, you know, more natural ingredients and one was prepared with like processed food ingredients. And the people who ate the natural food version of the meal performed better on the test an hour later They brought everybody back a few months later. They switched the meal and they found the same results again, even with the different group of people who had the ultra processed meal. So there's a really powerful connection between what's happening in our gut. You know, as we digest food, the food is broken apart and things are sent to the brain, not just nutrients, but certain foods that we eat cause inflammation that can be damaging to our brain function. So it is interesting to think about that the quality of the food that we're eating can impact our performance.
Now, even more specifically, I'm wondering about other types of hacks or whatever that people use. Like, for instance, you know, I saw someone talking about something called alpha GPC the other day, like one of these nootropics that supposedly these supplements that enhance brain power.
Yeah. When we talk about those, it's the Wild West. You know, there's no real strong research. Interestingly, the one that we have the most research with is caffeine. That's the one that actually has some evidence that it might improve memory. So like a cup of coffee or tea, you know, right before you're about to do something, a memory task might be improving for memory. But the other ones were still at the level of a lot of marketing, a lot of anecdotal evidence, a lot of, you know, maybe small animal studies, but where we don't really see evidence that, you know, there's a magic pill, that there's something that people can take that can, you know, improve their mental performance beyond if they have some underlying condition and that medication is going to be treating that condition and then improving their performance. But just for the general population, you know, it's a big field, but it's very unregulated, very Wild West, and people need to be careful because, you know, the last thing we want to do is hurting our brain because we hear that, you know, the enticement of if I just take this thing, it's going to be improving my performance.
That's interesting thing about caffeine. Like, I always thought caffeine was just suppressing the feelings of being tired, even if you are tired, so that it doesn't really help you. It just pretends to help you. So in general, I don't drink a lot of caffeine, but you're suggesting maybe a small amount might be okay I didn't know the connection between caffeine and memory.
Yeah, there are some interesting studies there. It's not at the point where we would say that, you know, people need to start drinking coffee or tea, but there is some evidence that if you drink coffee or tea, that there might be some benefits for anti-inflammatory. So we're thinking about caffeine in terms of, you know, coffee or tea as opposed to like a soda. So for example, in coffee or tea, there's some anti-inflammatory, there's these like polyphenols that we believe are good for the brain. But the caffeine itself, there is some evidence it can be helpful in memory, in concentration and focus, as long as it's not too much. You know, too much caffeine, people get jittery, they have trouble calming down. And the only other issue is that caffeine can have a long half-life. So if anyone's having any trouble sleeping, be careful of having caffeine past like noon or one. There's some people who can like down a cappuccino 5 minutes before bed and sleep just fine. They actually have different brain chemistry. They just metabolize caffeine differently. But there is some evidence that it's worth, you know, next time you want to do a mental task, take a little bit of caffeine and see how it improves your ability to perform.
Yeah, there was a book by Sanjeev Chopra, who's a doctor he works at Harvard, is Deepak Chopra's brother. And he wrote a book about the five most nutritious foods. And I think, if I remember correctly, caffeine might have been number one for him because of he said there's a lot of antioxidants in a cup of coffee.
Yeah, yeah. So if you're enjoying your coffee or tea in the morning, there's some evidence there that it could be beneficial.
And okay, now getting really specific into hacks. In the book, you mention how there were these two mice. One was very adventurous, the other was not so adventurous and very shy, and they switched kind of gut bacteria because there's a lot of brain cells in the gut. There's a lot of communication between the gut and the brain. And the shy mouse became more adventurous and the adventurous mouse became more shy. So I understand that there's been a lot of these types of tests on mice and I know the reasons why. Why haven't they tried such an easy thing on humans? This seems like an easy test to do on humans.
Well, it's the way that they do those tests with the mice in terms of switching bacteria. The mice have to be raised in a certain environment. It's called germ-free, and it's just not feasible with humans to have them born into that environment and then raise them that way. But what we do see is evidence that individuals who have certain conditions that you wouldn't think are related to the gut, anxiety, depression, Parkinson's, we're seeing with Alzheimer's as well, that there's a component of gut health there. And so, you know, there again, we people quickly jump to the marketing that, oh, everybody should be taking probiotics and that we should just be taking supplements to change our gut bacteria. Well, we see that for the vast majority of the population, that doesn't seem to do much of a benefit. But what you eat, and when we might go back to that study about the food that is processed versus not processed, that fundamentally changes the gut bacteria.
But what if I just take the gut bacteria of a 20-year-old and and put it in my gut?
Transplant it?
Yeah. I admit there's problems. It's not germ-free and all that, but better than nothing.
So this idea of bacterial transplants it's out there and it's on the, what I mean by out there is it's being done, it's on the horizon. And here's the problem is that I'll tell you the pros and the cons. The hope of this is that it will be figured out in a way that it will make a difference. Right now, what happens is that you already have so much bacteria, you know, trillions of bacteria cells in your gut. And so what happens is that when you try to introduce just a new type of bacteria in the gut, it's like a squirt gun in the ocean. It's hard to make a difference in terms of the transplant unless somebody has, you know, some significant underlying condition where there's something completely out of balance and we can try to push things in the other direction. So the changes that we see that are more beneficial now are with food because the bacteria eat food and certain types of bacteria, you feed them and these certain types of bacteria grow if they're fed and if other bacteria are starved, they die. So it's not an overnight process, but it takes time. But this idea of transplantation of bacteria, it's something to keep our eye on because it's part of the process. And if something like this, you know, down the road can be optimized, even for certain people with certain conditions, there's some hope there. It's just we're not just there yet. We're not ready to do things like this, you know, commercially. There are people that, you know, you can find things online, but be very careful of those things.
Like, have there been any studies with humans at all, or have there been any like odd anecdotal successes?
Yeah, there is. You know, not to get these studies get a little gross because of what we're talking about, but there's a condition called C. diff, which is individuals often catch this in the hospital, and it's a very dangerous form of bacteria that grows in the intestine, in the large intestine, and it's very hard to treat. They try to treat it with antibiotics, and it just comes back, and it's very, very challenging. So what they've done in some studies is they do a fecal transplant, and they basically take, because feces is filled with bacteria, so they take from a healthy person and they transplant it in to the person who's suffering from C. diff. And by doing that transplant, they've actually seen some benefit where people do better than being treated with antibiotics. So that's where we see the most evidence in what we would call like a bacteria transplant. But that's in a case where somebody is, you know, suffering from something like C. diff. There are biotech companies that have popped up and said, well, instead of doing it as a fecal transplant, let's see if we can put this in a pill. And those have not been as successful. So there is something synergistically happening amongst all these different types of bacteria that we don't quite understand yet and how to get the right combination to people. And so instead that where we see that's one example of success in a very specific situation.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now.
Save big money at Menards.
Now, in the book, you mentioned different types of memory. Like there's kind of focus memory where something's happening right in front of you. There's short-term memory. There's long-term memory. And kind of in the middle of, I guess, short-term memory, there's working memory. And I'm wondering if one problem as you get older is that your working memory, your ability to kind of, like for instance, I used to be a computer programmer. And when you're a computer programmer, you have to kind of keep track of all the code in your head simultaneously. So if something goes wrong, you can make an accurate guess, oh, it's from this part of the code because it's interacting in this way, you know, and so on. So working memory is very critical for these types of calculations. I'm wondering if there's a way to, you know, again, outside of the lifestyle changes, I wonder if there's a way to make working memory a little bigger, or maybe that shrinks as you get older.
Yeah, so working memory, the way you described it is correct. And one way to think about it is like scratch pad memory. Like it's the things you would write down on a scratch pad as you're like trying to take notes about something you're doing, but you're holding it in your head. And as we get older, this is a part of memory that can diminish. It can be much more challenging to kind of keep hold information. But by practicing that, so as we get older, and especially in our modern world where we have to do this less and less, you know, so much of the information that we want to remember is at our fingertips in terms of Googling it. It's in our phone. So actually just practicing this type of memory has been shown to be effective. So like just saying to yourself, you know, I'm going to set aside some time during the day and I'm going to practice trying to keep track of a calculation in my head. I'm going to do some math. I'm going to remember, try to memorize some phone numbers. I mean, it's so hard now to memorize a phone number. It's because this part of our brain has atrophied in our modern world, because we don't have to do it. So, you know, these skills are an element of this is that they're use it or lose it. And if we don't practice these skills, they do diminish. It can get harder as we get older. But oftentimes as we get older, we're not doing these things as much as we were when we were younger.
I mean, I guess in a lot of my activities in life, I have to have a big working memory. Like even this podcast, I had to not only read your book, but understand what questions I wanted to ask, remember them. So I'm not referring to notes or whatever. And similarly, like in chess, when you're making a decision, you're calculating all these lines. You have to remember before you make the decision what lines you calculated, what was good and what was bad. I'm wondering if, so in other words, I practice this a lot, but I wonder if it's just maintenance because I'm no longer able to improve it because of my age, whereas kids are able to improve it when they practice it.
Let me give you a compliment. It's amazing what I've done quite a few interviews, and the fact that you read the book, you're not using notes, and you are discussing it, it's amazing. Like what you're doing is amazing. So
thank you.
You know, yeah, like thinking of all the things that you might be concerned about, like what you're doing is incredible. So it's not easy to do that. So, you know, thinking about if you're seeing areas where you're like, I want to improve upon that, you know, trying to get kind of granular in what that is and saying like, it's kind of like if, you know, if you're exercising and you're going to the gym and, you know, you can generally improve things, but if you get down to like, what is the exact thing that I want to be working on, that I want to be improving, and sort of saying like, okay, what is that skill? Is it the idea of specifically tracking information in my brain? Am I losing information somewhere along the way? Is that the concern, or is it just in general the speed of the information that I'm able to calculate? Am I losing my train of thought along the way? And trying to figure out which of those things are someone is having difficulty, and then trying to assess, you know, specific exercises that can be done for those things. But also there's that layer, and then there's the layer of the sleep, the underlying issues, the diet. All those things come into play because the health of the brain causes those areas to be at their best. And as we get older, those things can slip in areas here and there. So it's kind of the balance of those two aspects.
But I wonder if the age-related aspect decreases, like let's say the working memory or the calculation speed, so much that the best you could hope for with all of these things is maintenance, which is good, which is fine. Like that's, you know, wards off dementia and Alzheimer's and so on potentially. But I wonder if there's a way to keep improving even as you age, but maybe it's just not.
Well, I can, there's these tests that they did in Finland, and they did these interventions that we're talking about, these lifestyle interventions, and people improved. They didn't just maintain. Mm-hmm. They saw improvements in, they gave them tests, big group of people. They looked at thousands of people. Half the people did the intervention, half the people didn't. The people who did their intervention, their test scores went up significantly. Their, you know, executive functioning went up significantly, and the processing speed of their brain went up significantly. So we do see, it's not just about maintenance. It's about, we do see evidence that things can be improved upon throughout the lifespan.
And then there's another factor with, which is sort of related to age, but not biologically, more environmentally, like, you know, as opposed to when I was younger. Now I have kids, you know, career yeah. issues, you know, I deal with lots of different people more than when I was a kid or younger. And I wonder if that has a role as well. But then again, when I was younger, I also was less equipped to handle, you know, multiple things going on in my life.
Yeah, it's definitely, there's pros and cons to both. So on one hand, as we get older, we gain the ability to manage our emotions better, but we have more oftentimes responsibilities, you know, not in all cases, but in many cases. And so that is, there's a lot of multitasking going around. And so something I do talk about in the book that can be helpful to what we've been discussing here is that the 10 seconds, if you had a chance to see that part, that it sounds so...
The 7-second rule, right?
Yeah, 7 to 10 seconds.
Yeah.
And so this idea that, you know, sometimes I say, give it an extra 3 seconds, make it 10 seconds. And so the idea is that, you know, we are multitasking a lot and we're also moving on to things very quickly. And so the part of your brain that's sort of holding information in the waiting room, it's called the hippocampus, it doesn't really want to remember things. Like there's all this filtering that goes on in the brain, and the hippocampus coordinates a lot of our memory functions. So working memory, short-term memory, recall, it's like Grand Central Station and kind of the waiting room of memory. And so if you want to remember something, it's so remarkably simple, but if we just think about our modern world where we're often not spending 2 seconds figuring out where we, or remembering where we parked our car, put our keys, we're just on to the next. It's just, when you want to remember something, saying to yourself, I'm just going to focus on this and nothing but this for an uninterrupted 7 to 10 seconds, because that allows that part of the brain to say, oh, this information is important. It transfers it to other parts of the brain where it's going to be remembered, as opposed to just throwing it away, because the brain is constantly trying to filter things out. And in our constant multitasking states or a constant state of distraction or overwhelm or, you know, tiredness or just moving on to things that we need to move on to quickly, our brain is often thinking, oh, this stuff is not probably that important for a long term. Let's just throw it away. And so that simple tip can be, you know, very effective, especially as we get older.
What do you think is the effect of social media on memory and calculation? Because, you know, when you let's say you spend an hour or two scrolling through your Facebook feed or Twitter feed or whatever,
yeah.
you're taking in all this information that is the brain has to go into overdrive filtering things because it's almost all useless.
Right, exactly. Yeah. So social media has, it's not all good and it's not all bad. On one level, the things that we're concerned about with social media are that it's highly, highly difficult to put it down. And, you know, brain scientists have been hired to make this content tap into parts of our brain that make it so that we just can't put it away. I mean, even, you know, when we're streaming things on TV nowadays, the next episode starts before the last episode ends. It's all about keeping you engaged, keeping you in this loop of constantly clicking the next thing or onto the next. That can keep us from sleeping. That can keep us from going outside. It can keep us from connecting with people in a much more probably meaningful way. And those are the concerns. It also can keep us from doing other activities that are good for our brain. But there's elements of social media that can be positive. It can connect us. We can learn new things. It can be relaxing in some cases. So the idea is that it's a balance. You know, social media can be good, but we want to keep it to doses and be highly aware that it's hard to keep it to doses. So sometimes we have to take, you know, strong action to say, I'm going to turn this off, put it in a drawer and set a boundary on this, because I know that if I don't, I'm going to be constantly checking it. And I talk in the book about these studies where even if your phone is off and in front of you, people score less on tests than if it's in another room, because your brain is seeing the phone and thinking, what am I missing? And these things like micro distraction or your brain thinking about things that are just in your visual field that you would think, oh, I'm not thinking about that. It is disrupting your ability to, you know, think at optimal levels.
And I'm wondering, is there, let's say you're making a decision and you're thinking very hard about it, you're concentrating, is there any benefit to looking away? Like you said, you could, when you look at things from multiple angles, sometimes that's helpful, but is there any benefit, for instance, to getting up and looking away as opposed to constantly churning on one problem?
Yeah, absolutely. So your brain works on things in the background. There's your conscious level of thought, and then there is your ability of your brain to sort of work on things in the background. And so there's these interesting studies, and I touch upon them in the book, about kind of this formula that people use who tend to really rise to the top of their field. And what they tend to do is they tend to focus without distraction. They put the phone away and they lock into what they need to be doing for, you know, a certain time during the day. It could be 20 minutes, could be 30 minutes, could be 40 minutes. But at the end of that time period, they take a break. They go for a walk. They go for a swim. They, you know, they do something else, because that ability to move on to something more mindless or more fun allows the brain to play with the information and look at it from multiple perspectives and multiple angles. So that's why dreams are so great, is because it's one of the only time during our day where our brain takes a break of thinking about things in a very structured, structured manner. So this idea of this dual benefit, or this ability of the brain to say, okay, I'm really going to focus on this, but then I'm going to take a break. A lot of our best ideas or breakthroughs or creative thought don't happen in the moment of the intense focus. They often come on the walk, or, you know, a little bit later while you're taking a swim or working out or doing something else, you just wake up. And that's because it's kind of like in the moment that you're focusing on it, you plant the seed, but you allow it to bloom later when you're just kind of letting your brain work on it in the background. Sounds so simple, but we oftentimes get stuck in this pattern of thinking where we're, you know, you're doing work, but you're checking a sports score, or you're checking a vacation website, or you're taking your break, but you're still answering a work email. And just separating out the boundaries and saying nothing but focus, nothing but break, back to nothing but focus, back to nothing but break, seems to be not only lessening burnout, but it also gets us off, you know, the hamster wheel, and allows us to use our brain in ways where we're just kind of getting the best of its ability, as opposed to just sort of balancing things, multitasking all day long. Nothing wrong with multitasking. Just we want to make sure some part of the day is more structured in these two ways of thinking.
Yeah, it's interesting. You mentioned how musicians often have these insights of creativity in the shower. The shower seems to be like the classic place, because I guess that's like a forced break, and there's no, it's not like you're on your phone in the shower. There's nothing there.
Right.
It's all interesting stuff. I mean, it's definitely an area of research where it's like critically important, not only for people who are at risk of dementia or Alzheimer's, but just as we get older and want to maintain relevance in the things we love doing, this is all important stuff, and we need to pay attention to it. So Dr. Mark Milstein, author of The Age-Proof Brain, and also your website, your personalbraincoach.com, I highly recommend people check that site out as well. Thank you so much for giving me so much useful information, which I'm gonna have salmon every night this week before my tournament this weekend. So thank you so much.
Oh, thank you. Thank you for having me on. It was really just so great to be here.
Thank you. If you like that episode, please, please subscribe to me wherever you get podcasts, because it helps my podcast stay alive and well. And I want you to subscribe. Please do it. Thank you so much.
This is a big year. The Ohio Lottery's golden anniversary. 50 years of excitement, of growing jackpots and crossed fingers. 50 years of funding for schools, of changed lives and brightened days. 50 years of fun, and that is worth celebrating. So watch for can't-miss promotions, huge events, and new games that will make the Ohio Lottery's 50th year its biggest one yet. Learn more at funturns50.com.
Save big money at Menards. Keep your lawn looking its best with Menards' premium four-part fertilizer program. Each step is tailor-made for the health of your lawn. Get started this spring with a bag of crabgrass preventer with lawn food. Apply just once early in the spring to feed your lawn for over 2 months. Pick it up in our garden center today and check out Menards.com for more hot deals happening now.
Save big money.